This is Good Charity, Bad Charity.
I'm Keith Davis.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
And I'm David Prest. Now, we're going to start with a bit of a plug for the Good Charity, Bad Charity website, which is now up and running. The domain address is
www.goodcharitybadcharity.com.
All sorts of information about the programme there, some nice mugshots that we had taken of a couple of weeks ago. But also, it's an opportunity for you to help us to do the work that we do. So there's a page there where you can become a friend of the show and you can contact us for more details about how to do that. We also want lots of interaction. So if you've got an idea for somebody that you think should be in the guest chair here, we want you to drop us a line.
And we're here to polish a few halos, really.
Polish a few halos and scoop up a few turds. Are you allowed to say that?
If you can say bollocks in the House of Commons, then yeah, I would assume you could say.
Our theme today is clearly going to be the four legs good, two legs bad variety, okay? We're talking about animals. And we have an extraordinary opportunity to talk to the chief exec of the RSPCA. That man is Chris Sherwood, a man with an awful lot of problems on his plate. We'll talk more about that later. But before we do, let's talk about animals.
Yeah, well, I'm a doggy guy, aren't I?
You're a dog man.
I've said that before. I'm a dog man.
I wouldn't trust a cat.
No, nor would I.
It's a trust issue with cats for me. Mm. They look at you with that sort of slightly condescending air. And dogs essentially are a little bit thick, aren't they?
They're not thick in that sense. My bitch at the moment is starting to ignore me.
What's she called?
Tara.
Tara. Nice name.
Yeah, and she's starting to ignore me. So if she's in the garden, I call her in. It's like, I will come at my own pace, thank you. Mm. And she wanders around and she'll sniff something else.
But all very visual, Keith. But can she have a conversation? Can she sit down and say, well, this is actually what I think about governance, Keith? As opposed to, I'll go for a walk or I'm not going to go for a walk. And to me, that's the limit of animals.
So that's really interesting, isn't it? You know, I never had you down as being that anti-animals, really, in that sense.
It's not anti, it's like indifference. It's I did have a guppy once, but...
A guppy?
I can't really have a conversation with that.
Is that Canadian for goldfish, effectively?
No, it isn't gold. They're grey, okay, and that's why they keep getting lost.
I remember as a kid, we used to have little Border Terriers, and we had two Border Terriers, one called Benny and one called Sandy. Mm-hmm. Sandy was a lovely little dog, and one day he got into a bit of a tussle with a whippet, I think, and the whippet sort of did what whippets do. Sandy came back considerably worse for wear, and my dad had to put him down in the garage. Yeah. So it was all a bit of a traumatic experience. I remember it as a kid, and just kind of thinking, you have this affection for something, and then suddenly this tragic.
Exactly. And now your parents have got to go through the thing. So everybody says, as a good parent, you should give your kid the opportunity to have a pet because it teaches them to care for other things. And then the pet dies, and now you have to educate them about trauma and death.
But it is.
Really?
Yeah, it is a bereavement process for people.
That's quite interesting. If we have to develop the caring, the charitable gene into a new generation, maybe pets are very much part of that. You know, you give kids a gerbil or whatever it is, and they do have to fend for them, look after them, they have a responsibility. It is almost like deeply ingrained within the concept and the philosophy of charity, isn't it? Really?
It is, and there's a lot of dogs now going into care homes as pat dogs and stroke dogs.
Oh, and there is a big thing about emotional support dogs. Mm. So it's not just about, say, a guide dog, which has a very specific function and which can be allowed into certain public places that other animals wouldn't be allowed. But emotional support dogs, they have a word for it, for that companionship, for that caring for something else other than yourself. I guess my question always is, why can't that be a human being?
Maybe they're not as caring.
So it's going to be an interesting conversation. Looking forward to talking to Chris Sherwood, who's the chief exec of the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. I'm going to start this segment with a random list of animals, okay? Cats, dogs, donkeys, hamsters, seals, budgies, snakes, big cats. Amazingly, these have all come under the responsibility and have all been cases that the RSPCA has had to step in and help with. And we're very excited to have with us today Chris Sherwood, who is the Chief Executive of the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. You've had more than 15 years' experience in the charity sector, previously as Chief Exec of Relate. You were instrumental in moving Relate to a new organisational structure. You joined the RSPCA, whose mission, of course, is by all lawful means to prevent cruelty, promote kindness to and alleviate the suffering of animals. Established in 1824, extraordinary to think of that. It's the oldest and largest animal welfare organisation in the world. But, and there is a bit of a but coming, I'm sorry about this, Chris, but there is a challenge for you ahead. In the last 2.5 years, there's been a damning bullying report where 46% of staff have reported serious or very serious bullying within the organisation. The Charity Commission, on a number of occasions, has claimed the RSPCA has fallen short on issues of governance, and there's also been attacks because of the unique way that the RSPCA is organised. You do bring private prosecutions yourself. You've been attacked for overzealous prosecutions. So lots of big questions, but we're going to start by asking you, Chris Sherwood, are you a dog man or are you a cat man?
Well, I am definitely a cat man, I'm afraid. And I am a massive lover of black cats, followed by Ginger Toms. And one of the great things about this job is that when I'm having a bit of a difficult week, I can go off and visit a cattery and spend a bit of time communing with some lovely kittens. In fact, I was over in our cattery in Southall a couple of weeks ago, and we're outside kitten season at the moment. So I was very surprised when I walked into the isolation room to find these gorgeous little kittens, and I had this grey kitten with just a little white ring on the end of his tail. And I've never heard a kind of weak old kitten hiss at you before, but it was just so delicious to listen to this cat.
And is this a childhood thing? Because you grew up in an urban environment. We were around animals at a young age.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a working class kid from Corby in Northamptonshire, which is one of those kind of former steel towns, and the steelworks closed down in the sort of 1980s. So it wasn't the most easy environment to grow up in. But yeah, I was surrounded by animals. I had three dogs. We had chickens in our back garden. We had tropical fish, and I lived on the edge of the town, so I spent quite a lot of time taking my dogs for walks through the countryside as well. So, you know, and I think what I learned from that was kind of growing up in a kind of community that was facing some real challenges, and not necessarily growing up in the best family. You know, both my parents were alcohol dependent. It was a sort of difficult time to grow up. Actually, my dogs were a real incredible source of support, and in my little single bed, I'd have all three of them sleep in the single bed with me as well. So. So it was an incredible source of support for me as a kind of child growing up in that kind of community.
Okay, what sort of dogs?
Well, we had Rusty, who was an English Springer Spaniel, and then we had Dusty, who was a mutt. And then me and my sister did encourage them to get married. And so we had a lovely puppy, Patch, who came along, which was a bit of a surprise to my parents. And clearly now we would advise that both those dogs had been neutered or spayed.
Camilla.
So is this your ideal job then, Chris?
I mean, I'm so fortunate to have worked for some of the best charities in the sector. You know, I thought Relate was my ideal job when I was at Relate, and then I came to the RSPCA, and absolutely this is my ideal job. And, you know, when I went for the role, I really wanted it, but I just wasn't sure I would get it. And when I was offered it, I was just over the moon, because the work that we do for animals every single day of the week is phenomenal. Our 350 inspectors are out there in all weathers rescuing animals. Our animal centres go above and beyond the call of duty to care for and rehabilitate animals in our care, and so do our hospitals. So, you know, I do take on the role with a bit of trepidation and definitely some humility, because this, as you've said, it's an organisation that's been around for 194 years, and all of a sudden they've let this working class kid from Corby become the chief exec.
But how do you get your head around it all? Because it isn't just the RSPCA. It's the RSPCA Shropshire, the RSPCA Lancashire. So you have a federated organisation with you at the head of it. First of all, how can you possibly know what's going on? And secondly, how do you keep control? Because there has to be some element of control.
I'd say as a chief exec in that kind of structure, persuasion, engagement, collaboration, making the case, no surprises are really important principles that you have to adhere to. I don't think you function very well as a chief exec in those kinds of structures if you're all about command and control, it's my way or the highway.
Yeah.
Because when you've got branches that are independent charities in their own right, with their own charity number, their own board of trustees, they can say, well, that's very well and good, Camilla, but we ain't doing it. And you try and make us do it. So persuasion is really important. I think there are some real benefits that come from this kind of structure, though. I mean, we have coverage across the whole of England and Wales. And when you go into a local committee meeting, you'll hear about the passion and energy for making a difference for animals in that community. And you can lose that in a unitary structure because budgets get decided at a regional level or a sub-regional level. And so the focus on the community of the New Forest or the focus on the community of Yeovil and South Somerset can get lost in that kind of unitary structure. But there are some challenges around it. Clearly, delivering change can take some time because you have to make the case, you have to persuade. But if you can persuade people and you can make the case, then that change can actually be quite powerful.
You've got now a report that's come out that says you're going to reduce from 25 on your council, as you call it, down to 12. What processes are you going through at the present moment in time then to try and select those 12?
Well, there's a big step we need to take before we get to that point. So we're in the start of probably the most important year in terms of reforming our governance since 1974.
Yeah. We know that.
Yep.
We're starting a big conversation with our members and with our branches about a set of changes that we want to see in the organisation. Part of that is reducing the size of our council down from 25 members to 12, of which 3 would be co-opted so that we can look outside of the RSPCA network for particular skills. You know, we're north of £100 million charity. We want to have people with the skills and experience on council in addition to those that we've got. And why are we doing that? We're doing that because we want the best governance, because if we get the best governance, it will enable us to do far more for animal welfare. And that's what this is all about.
You've clearly spent some time looking at the organisation and come to the conclusion that this change is needed. But, of course, we can't ignore the fact that you've been forced to do this by the reports of the Charity Commission, which have pointed to serious concerns over governance. We'll come on to the bullying in a minute, because that is obviously part of that governance issue as well. But how have you felt morale has been affected by those things?
I think in terms of what I've picked up in the RSPCA in terms of morale, you know, you mentioned the Unite Bullying survey. I mean, I read that before I came into posts. You know, I read the full document, and it didn't fill me with, you know, lots of joy and happiness. You know,
it's clearly... shock you?
I think it's very concerning. I think the aspects that the survey talks about is very concerning. I think the starting point for me is it's okay diagnosing the problem. It's what you do about it. It's the issue.
But you have to diagnose the problem, don't you? I mean, have you yourself looked into it and said, okay, yes, we were at fault and this is why we were at fault?
Yeah, I think we have absolutely looked at it, looked at where I think that is an issue in certain parts of the organisation.
Well, what was the problem then?
I think that we haven't invested as an organisation in management development. We've promoted people in the organisation to be managers without giving them the skills. And I think that one of the things that we're doing this year is we're investing in a programme of management development to give people good management skills. We've also just refreshed our exec team. So we've, you know, I've been recruiting a team, which is very much in the spirit of the kind of culture I want, which is open, transparent, collaborative, empowering, and quite frankly, a zero tolerance approach to bullying. It's just not acceptable in a 21st century workplace to have that kind of culture.
But when you start looking at this sort of issue, and you, especially with the Unite report, which we talk about, 46% of staff saying that they thought it was serious or very serious, the bullying problem within the RSPCA, and I think the figure is 38% of that, the source of the bullying was from senior managers. I mean, when you then start confronting individuals, how do you have those conversations? You've had those awkward conversations. People have left the organisation, I'm guessing.
I mean, you know, in the survey, it's very concerning that nearly 1 in 3 people say they've experienced bullying. And that is not a number that I'm proud of in the organisation. So again, what have I done about that? I've appointed a people director. I deliberately called that director post people and culture rather than a traditional HR director, because I think it is about actually how we move our culture on. I think we can kind of get into an issue where we say, well, it's that individual or that individual. I think actually the culture of the organisation needs to move on, and very much what I see my role as the chief exec is that modernising approach. We just ran a series of what we call Your Voice events, which is where members of staff could come in and talk to the chief exec and talk to members of the directors team to put a human face on people who are leading the organisation. Those have been really welcomed by staff because it's been a new approach to actually have that engagement, to sit down, actually have a cup of tea and a conversation with the chief exec. I'd like to see a culture where someone comes and say, well, we know you said this, Chris, but you haven't done it. You know, that was the kind of culture that I tried to nurture at Relate. The last thing I'd say is the power of social media. I mean, I use Twitter a lot to share what I'm doing. That's part of that kind of culture, which is trying to move away from the kind of hierarchical approach. I'm not particularly good at hierarchy myself. You know, it's not
but it's sometimes, Chris, isn't it also about being really, really simple? And I wonder when it comes down to things like bullying, if you simply say things like, it is totally unacceptable for anyone in this room ever to be shouted at, and that's the experience of a lot of people in all sorts of sectors, I don't want you to embroider it and hang it on the wall, but I'm suggesting that maybe that's what has to happen.
I'm honest to say, I've never shouted in the workplace. You know, I would never do that. You know, it's completely inappropriate behaviour, and I would never want to be shouted at in the workplace. You know, that is not the kind of culture we want to see. You know, we're living in the era of hashtag Me Too and the power of social media to call out those kinds of acts of abuse. And we've seen it in intimate relationships, obviously I'm very familiar with from my time at Relay, and we're seeing it in terms of workplace relationships. And again, I go back to, you know, I think the RSPCA's mission is an exciting and inspiring mission, not just for the RSPCA, but for our country, actually. You know, if we can have a world where we're kind to animals, then, you know, that's a world where we're kind to each other.
But isn't the, I mean, the irony, sorry to keep bringing it back, but isn't the irony there that, you know, this is an organisation being kind to animals, and yet it hasn't been kind to its own staff in the past? And if we look at the comparison with the Oxfams and the organisations that have had very public difficulties, and their worry about the impact that that's going to have on people giving to that organisation, you're in a perhaps more vulnerable position. You are totally, as I understand it, reliant on public gifts. Are you concerned that these stories that have been reasonably public will affect the giving?
The RSPCA absolutely operates on the generosity of the public. And touch wood, you know, during the difficult financial times that we've had and the impact on the markets, our income has been broadly stable. And that is something that we don't take for granted. And we work very hard to kind of maintain that relationship with our thousands and thousands of donors that give money every year to the RSPCA.
But are those donors, are there any of those donors reporting to you, look, we don't want to give to the RSPCA this year or whatever it may be because of the reports that we've been hearing?
We do have situations where a piece of media coverage does result in, you know, a very small number of donors who will write to us to express concerns about it. But I think I would just caution one thing, which is, you know, our media coverage, the vast majority of that is positive. You know, 99% of our media coverage is positive, because actually what I think the public are interested in is the stories of an inspector who's rescuing that nosy fox who's got his head stuck in a car grill, or a cat who's been stuck up a tree, or the deer who's wandered out of the woods and got stuck in someone's back garden. That's the kind of relationship we have with the public, and that's the stories that they see, and they see that through their local media coverage and some of the excellent TV programmes that are showcasing our work, like the Dog Rescuers programme or Joe Brand's Cats and Kittens. You know, the negative media coverage we get is 1%. And some of that negative media coverage comes from sources who probably think that we should just go back to being an organisation that just cares for cats and dogs and doesn't express more political views.
I was interested with your comment about the digital transformation. Coming in on the side of, OK, you're using it, how would you recommend other charities should use it then?
I think the challenge for charities around technology that I see is that there isn't an abundance of funders out there who's coming in to give them money to invest in their website or their digital channels. Charities are really having to look at how they use their own surpluses or their own reserves to invest in this. And I think that I would kind of certainly advise boards to make sure you're getting good advice, because I've seen boards who've landed in a, you know, technology is the panacea to all of our problems, or a more negative view, which is, you know, NHS database went wrong and they always go over budget and they always cost a fortune. It's probably somewhere in the middle, but it is about getting good advice, good information about what you're doing, really.
Isn't it interesting? Social media is there, and of course the great sharing activity on social media is related to cats and dogs and animals doing funny things. I mean, how do you stop yourself from the temptation of basically, well, we can get in on this, we can, well, let's put pictures of badly beaten dogs, badly beaten animals, let's promote ourselves, use that relationship with animals and turn it into something a little bit more, well, that's menacing in a way. I mean, I feel uneasy about that.
We actually take about 5,000 calls a year about cases of animal cruelty through social media. So, you know, some of the horrific stories we've heard about is a squirrel that was set on fire and filmed on Snapchat and shared through Snapchat, or a pigeon that was force-fed alcohol and cigarettes and then shared via social media. And that is a real concern for us, which is why we launched our Generation Kind campaign, because what we're really concerned about is that young people are far more exposed to those images of cruelty than any previous generation. Mm-hmm. You know, that we 3% of young people
say, porn and everything.
Yeah, 3% of young people say that they have seen animal cruelty in person, but a significant more say they've seen it through social media. And we want to make sure that the kind of group of young people that are growing up today grow up to be the kindest generation to animals, not a generation that's desensitized because animal cruelty becomes part of that tapestry of what they see through their social media channels, which is why we've launched our Generation Kind campaign, which is a whole series of projects across the country, which are trying to get those prevention messages out there. You know, that one of the things our inspectors do see is that the main in-tray thing that they have isn't deliberate cruelty. It's neglect through lack of education and lack of information. And it's that education about how to care for animals, how to show compassion and empathy towards animals that our Generation Kind campaign is trying to do.
Can I pick up on the other side then? Because there is a big debate going on still, I assume, about your overall role in prosecutions. Okay. You've done it for X number of years, obviously. Is now the time, though, because you're so passionate about the caring side, that you should get out of prosecutions and leave that to the police so that you can focus on what you're saying about we're the caring community?
Well, I think that, you know, the RSPCA plays a number of roles there. So obviously the P in our name is about prevention. You know, we do an awful lot of work around prevention. We have that rescuing work that we do through our inspectors. But we do see those examples of deliberate animal cruelty. In fact, you know, we've had a number of illegal puppy farms that we've raided in the past 12 months where we're seeing breeding bitches and puppies being kept in some of the most disgusting conditions.
Yeah.
And in those kinds of cases, you know, we do take a decision to prosecute. Now, the thing for me is important is that in our current situation, the police often come to the RSPCA because we have the skills and experience and the veterinary practice to be able to make good judgments in those kinds of cases. And we also have some resources that we earmark as part of that. And 89% of the public like the fact the RSPCA takes up prosecutions. You know, I think part of the debate we've had in the organisation historically has been if there was resources in the CPS or in the police force, or there was the skills and experience in those institutions to be able to play that role, then it may be a different debate. But actually, when we look at what's out there, we see that police forces are under huge budgetary pressure and don't have the resources to be able to take forward those cases, or not necessarily the skills and experience to do it. But when we prosecute, we don't prosecute lightly. You know, most of our work before we get to prosecution will involve an inspector visiting that household, trying to address the issues in situ. And we have seen the overall number of prosecutions come down, which we think actually is in part because the Animal Welfare Act has been enforced since 2006. There's been some cultural and attitudinal shifts that have taken place in our society. Our public messages about caring for animals and prevention has got out there. But I think I do personally think, under my leadership organisation, that our prosecution role is an important part of what we do. And I, you know, when I look around the globe, I know that our sister organisations often play that role as well. Because if we didn't prosecute in those cases, who would?
It's a really small point, but do you think there's any reality, let's say, to the perception that something like the RSPCA is a natural big C conservative constituency, rather than cross-party or apolitical?
I mean, I think the RSPCA is absolutely apolitical. And I think the RSPCA has worked with different complexions of government. In fact, we gave a Politician of the Year award last year to Michael Gove, which wasn't necessarily universally celebrated by all of our supporters. But we did that because there are some things that we support Michael Gove is doing around increasing of sentencing under the Animal Welfare Act, the reforms that are being proposed to link future subsidies in farming policy in the UK to higher animal welfare standards, we support that. Introducing CCTV into abattoirs, we support that. But we really disagree with the government over the badger cull. And we're very open about that. So, you know, we're absolutely an organisation that will work with politicians from different parties to advocate for our agenda, which is, you know, alleviating suffering, promoting kindness and preventing cruelty to animals.
You haven't always had friends from the right of the political spectrum. I mean, the Times leader in 2016, which I dare say is written on a piece of paper at some stage somewhere in your organisation, the RSPCA has become a shrill, vindictive and fanatical lobby group that's veered off into areas far from its traditional mandate. The campaign against hunting, the support lent to animal rights groups and the flurry of private prosecution against farmers and individual animal owners. The reputation has, over the past two decades, been shredded. Silence.
I didn't get a Christmas card from
David Cameron.
From the writer. That's all I can say. I mean, look, I go back to the organisation, the RSPCA is an incredibly well-known brand. It absolutely is the kind of charity you can have a pub conversation with and someone's got an opinion on the RSPCA. But most of the coverage that we get is positive, because actually what the RSPCA is about making the difference at the local level by our inspectors, rescuing animals who are in crisis or in difficulty. And we advocate on behalf of animals. And sometimes that means we have to speak truth to power. You know, things like, you know, the Hunting Act, we were incredibly passionate about bringing in the Hunting with Dogs Act. I personally was very passionate about bringing in the Hunting with Dogs Act, and we're not going to change our opinion on that.
Was it right to go after David Cameron's local hunt so aggressively?
I think at the time, and again, I smile because, you know, we're talking such a long time ago. Do you remember what it was like under the coalition government? I mean, doesn't public policy doesn't it seem different? You know, I think the thing is that, you know, with hunting prosecutions now, our position after the Waller Review is that we would refer a hunting prosecution to the police, and if they didn't act, we reserve the right to be able to prosecute. What we want to see is the Hunting with Dogs Act legislation enforced, because that is the law of the land, and we want to see that. And our position around hunting and blood sports more generally is very well known, and it's a position that I take as well very strongly.
Chris, you're in a new job, which is hugely pressured. Does a sense of humour help? Does anything help? What helps?
Well, I mean, I don't think you can be a chief exec of a charity today and not have a sense of humour. you know, I mean, the way I keep saying is, you know, I'm really blessed to have a great sort of source of friends and a supportive partner and, you know, a kind of network of chief execs who look out for me. But my passion outside of work is going off on kind of treks and trips around the world. So I've just come back from a couple of weeks from South America, where I spent sort of a
Brilliant.
Few weeks trekking in
been
the Andes.
Been to Canada?
I have been to Canada many times, actually.
Excellent.
Yeah, you know, I think I've done 56 or 57 countries now, and I tend to go off the beaten track places as well. So that's the thing that keeps me
commune with nature,
get out. In fact, I sat watching eagles dance around my head as I was eating breakfast up in the Andes. That was
Fantastic.
Absolutely gorgeous
Brilliant.
To watch.
I think we're absolutely in awe of your ability to cope with this organisation and to address very honestly the problems that have been in the recent past. And it's great of you to come on the programme. Mm. I'm going to ask you two very cheeky questions. First of all, Brexit, good or bad for animal protection?
Offers opportunities for us through the Agriculture Bill, but also challenges as well. And ensuring that the good commitments the government has made about, you know, preserving high animal welfare standards in our farming industry are protected if we start to negotiate free trade deals around the world.
And secondly, the big question, your pet porn star name. So the pet, the name of your first pet and your mother's maiden name. Mine's Sandy Bentley, Keith.
Mine's Lupin Martin.
Mine's Guppy Marsden.
Mine's Snowy Brakel.
That's
Ooh,
good.
That's good.
I'll definitely buy that one. All right then. Yep. Thank you very much, Chris Sherwood. It's been fantastic to have you in. Yeah. So that was Chris Sherwood, chief exec of the RSPCA, a man who is incredibly amiable.
Yeah.
A big beaming smile. He's
I
a
love
naturally
that.
Empathetic and actually compassionate person. And you have to say, the RSPCA, in the state it has been, with a series of chief execs coming and going, and crises which on the verge of being very public and very embarrassing, there's a man who you can see is picked for the job.
Yeah, and I think I'd love to have him back in this room in a year's time to say, OK, so what?
Yeah, show us the difference. Yeah.
Because that will send a good message to other charities out there who are going to have to say, we need to refresh our boards, refresh our trustees, in order to deliver for the future.
There's something else, which is that, you know, he describes himself as an old millennial. I imagine he has come into this organisation, which is very traditional, slightly sort of set in its ways about how it organises itself. And there's almost like a generational shift going on. And I think that what he's describing is probably common in a lot of charities at the moment. There's a different mindset coming from a younger generation of people entering the charity sector, possibly.
But the generational thing, his fundraising comes from two areas, donations and legacies. Donations, I can see whereby somebody going on Instagram and seeing a puppy is going to click a bunch of numbers on the mobile phone, and somehow that will become a digital way of giving a donation. A legacy is generally given by somebody who's quite a lot older, who won't particularly be responding to that kind of mission that Chris is on, and has to either be helped to understand why it's a good thing, or to be approached to still give that legacy, because are the millennials going to be leaving massive legacies to the RSPCA in 40 years to 50 years' time? I don't know whether that's the case.
I doubt it, if I'm honest. Mind you, if he's an old millennium, we must be prehistoric.
Speak for yourself, you two.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity, the podcast which aims to... What do we aim to do?
Educate, enthrall, enthuse.
Entertain.
Oh, entertain as well. There you go. Mr. Entertainer himself, Mr. Keith Davis. And a big thank you to Dan Hardoon, to Whistledown Productions. Find us online. We'll share and spread the word. Don't forget to come and have a look at our website. You can fund us there. You can help support the work that we do. We'll be very grateful for anything you can do to help us. And as ever, we're grateful for your comments too. From me, David Prest, from Camilla.
Camilla McGibbon, goodbye.
And from Keith Davis. Take care.